Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Hi, everybody, and welcome back to New Books in East Asian Studies, a podcast channel on the New Books Network. I'm Ed Pulford, one of the hosts of the channel. On the podcast today, we have Taomor Zhou, who's assistant professor in the School of Humanities at Nanyang Technological University in Singapore. And she'll be talking about her new book, Migration in the Time of Revolution, China, Indonesia, and the Cold War, which was published in 2019 by Cornell University Press. Stories of China's opening up to the world in the late 20th and early 21st centuries at times seem to suggest that the country was completely closed before this, as though the revolutionary period from the 1940s onwards was simply one of domestic turmoil and introversion. Of course, though, this is very far from the truth, for on multiple levels this period was as international as any other in China's recent past, something seen both on the official level in the formal internationalism of socialist and third world solidarity, and in more everyday ways in the activities of the vast population of more or less Chinese people living beyond the boundaries of what we now call China. Both of these vectors played into the nascent PRC's engagement with the wider world, and these are explored in fascinating depth in Taomor Zhou's Migration in the Time of Revolution, which focuses in particular on the overseas Chinese population in Indonesia and what their 20th century experiences tell us about broader regional and global affairs during the Cold War. Drawing in a vast range of material derived from archival work and, perhaps most intriguingly, on-the-ground fieldwork, this book presents a rich account of the Indonesian Chinese population's entanglements in everything from Chinese civil war, Beijing-Taipei rivalries after 1949, Indonesian independence, Cold War alliance building, and the Cultural Revolution, to name just a few. What results is a book that treads new ground in multiple ways, shedding light on a key bottom-up angle to 20th century geopolitics in Asia and beyond, and revealing, I have to say, some absolutely fascinating accounts of those who returned to China after 1949 and how they fared in the young socialist state. But to talk about all of these things and how they expand our understanding of macro-level events at ground level, I'll say Taomor Zhou, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you so much for the generous introduction. I'm glad to be here, Ed.
Well, it's a pleasure to have you on, and I'm greatly looking forward to talking about this very cool book. But before we do, perhaps I'll begin by asking you how it was that you became interested in Indonesia, Southeast Asia. You're based yourself in Singapore, and this particularly interesting tale of migration and the like.
Right. So when I was doing research for this book, I was frequently asked whether, you know, I myself was Chinese Indonesian. Actually, I was born in Harbin, the bustling Sino-Russian entry port, which was vividly featured in your own book, The Mirrorlands. And my family moved all the way south to Shenzhen in early 1990s. So Shenzhen probably became known as the Silicon Valley of China and it's bordering Hong Kong. And I studied for my undergrad at Peking University. I spent a year at Waseda as an exchange student in Tokyo. And later, for my master's, I was at the London School of Economics. And later, I pursued my PhD at Cornell. And now, as you mentioned, I'm working in Singapore. So I guess throughout these journeys, I'm always curious about two things. On a micro level, I'm always fascinated about international relations or politics and the spread of ideology, particularly communism. And secondly, I'm curious about the human stories, and particularly the movement and mobility of people, especially how experiences of migrants, whether they're assimilation, discrimination, they experience change the way they perceive themselves or are perceived by others. So in other words, although I'm not Chinese Indonesian myself, but the mirroring experience, to quote you again, of like seeing my own Chinese identity shift and change over time in different social contexts, in different geopolitical background, kind of inspire this project.
Mm, very interesting. And so how did the actual book itself kind of come about as a project?
Right. So I would say I started probably in the wrong way. I understand, like, for most graduate students, like, they probably start with a broad thematical interest in a particular field or in a particular region. But for me, it just happens that I hit the jackpot in the beginning. So in between 2006 and 2007, I think it's between 2006 and around 2012, the Chinese Foreign Ministry Archives opened up. And it was during that time I was in Beijing, and one of my professors at Peking University mentioned to me, like, you know, Indonesian Communist Party was actually the largest non-ruling Communist Party during the Cold War, and we don't know much about the relation between Beijing and its Indonesian comrades. So I took the chance and went into the Chinese Foreign Ministry Archive. So that was, as you know from reading the book, that's the bulk of the governmental documents used in the book. So I have this whole treasure trove of material, and I spent basically 6 years of my PhD trying to figure out how to make sense of it and how to make the story relevant to the broader academia.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, I think you do that very successfully, and add in all kinds of, you know, more, I guess, personal and on the ground insights too, which we'll have chance to talk about, I think, as we get into the book. But I guess it leads us quite well into the introduction. You're having just mentioned this intriguing fact that the Indonesian Communist Party was the biggest non-ruling one during the Cold War and so on. I think because the Southeast Asian component to this book takes us a little outside the immediate remit of East Asian studies, you'd perhaps, if you could, would you be able to give us a bit of a picture of who the Chinese population in Indonesia is? I mean, it's a question you posed yourself in the introduction. So you have established that you are not one, but who are they, the overseas Chinese in Indonesia?
Right. That's a very good question. So here, I would say, like, historians of Chinese migration always debate about the subject of their study, right? So, like, to quote culture studies scholar like Ian An, who famously authored a book on not speaking Chinese. So this idea of Chineseness is always contested, it's malleable, and it's kind of constantly remade and reshaped under different social contexts. So in the book, I think I'll try to emphasize the diversity, the fluidity, and hybridity of the Chinese identity. But I think here I'll just focus on three dimensions. So one is, like, in turn, there are different degrees of culture assimilation, right? So those who are more assimilated, in a sense that they use Bahasa Indonesia or Marki Malay as their main language, are usually categorized as Peranakan, whereas those who tend to use Mandarin Chinese or other Chinese dialect as their main language are usually recognized as Totok or Xinke, so indicating that they themselves are new migrants or descendants of new migrants to Indonesia. And of course, these two categories are distinct but not mutually exclusive, right? And the idea that you know, there is a racial distinction between pribumi or so-called indigenous Indonesians and Chinese is somehow a colonial legacy. You can say it's artificial creation and it's constantly used by political actors in Indonesia for a political gain, right? So one anecdote I wrote in the book is that in 1961, like the charismatic Indonesian president Sukarno, he met with Mao Zedong, the Chinese chairman, and he basically took off his hat and showed his black hair to Mao and say, look, you know, you can hardly tell whether I'm indigenous or not, right? Maybe I have the Chinese blood. So, but there's, of course, Sukarno was trying to charm Mao to diffuse any diplomatic tension, but it shows that, you know, some Peranakan are really highly integrated into local society, either through intermarriage or adaptation of local language or cultural practices. And also there is, I guess, another prominent theme in the book is that there is always this conflation of ethnicity and class. So there is this popular kind of understanding that all Chinese are belong to the merchant class. Of course, one can admit that the merchant class was and is the most dominant group, but this is kind of a manifestation of the Dutch colonial policy that in which the Chinese were categorized as foreign orientals and separated from the natives, right? So Baran, which probably we'll talk about later, he was the first Chinese ambassador to Indonesia. He said like, oh, of course, in the eyes of some indigenous elites, every Chinese has a shop, has a company, but they're only seeing like only a few big trees and they're saying, oh, look, the whole forest is made of all these skyscraper trees or gigantic trees. So there are Chinese engaged in fishery, in agriculture. So the kind of their humble, modest backgrounds were obscured by the prominent wealth of a small group of Chinese.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And I think, yeah, you chart the kind of shifting perception of the community over time in a very fascinating way, because of course, amidst great political shifts in the region and in the specific relationship between China and Indonesia, these people come to be viewed very differently, as you show. But I also wonder, in perhaps some excessively naive kind of a question, whether you could give us a sense of the recent history of Indonesia. I know that's a massive sort of subject, but you mentioned the Dutch colonial era there. So what was the sort of Cold War, well, post-independence and sort of Cold War situation in Indonesia, and specifically, how did it relate to the Chinese community there?
Absolutely. So, I mean, I think I'll just recap on, emphasize on three key turning points. So 1945, 1955, and then 1965. So basically, the book was trying to show that in this two decade span, Indonesia's relationship with China reflect kind of Indonesia's own anxiety as a very diverse, newly decolonized nation state. So in other words, the problems that emerged in Sino-Indonesian relations were not just foreign policy issues, right? They were kind of entangled, as the word you use in the introduction, or entanglement is a big theme of the book. So it's an entanglement with Indonesia's domestic issue of like whether it's forging national identity or its control of ethnic minorities and control of the borderlands. So basically, to briefly summarize, the geographic boundary of what today is known as Indonesia was set by the Dutch. So they came in early 17th century and they established the Dutch East Indies as one unified colony. So one can argue that under the Dutch, Indonesians began to conceive of themselves as one nation. And then the Japanese came in 1942, and many historians saw that as a watershed moment, as they brought in military rituals. They militarized the youth and the nationalist movement among like younger generation of Indonesians gained more momentum. So in 1945, Indonesia declared its independence, but it was still a daunting challenge for the nationalist leaders to instill a sense of common identity, because this is, after all, a country kind of spread across the equator, consisting of like 19,000 islands. So also they had to continue fighting against Dutch attempt to recolonize. So this struggle is known as the Indonesian National Revolution. It ended in 1949, and the sovereignty was transferred from the Dutch to Indonesian hands in the end. So in 1955, I think many of the listeners will be familiar with the Afro-Asian Conference held in Bandung. So it's a moment of glamour, and Indonesia really kind of fashioned itself as a pioneer in the Afro-Asia solidarity movement. So Sukarno, the charismatic host of the Afro-Asian Conference, he announced that the formerly voiceless, invisible third world nations are now very adamant in their demand for autonomy in the Cold War. And then fast forward to 1965. So that's the climax of the book, the September 30th movement and ensuing mass violence and regime change in Indonesia, in which Sukarno was ousted by Suharto. So September 30th movement probably gained more visibility with the release of Joshua Oppenheimer's documentary, which was highly controversial but very impactful, like the act of killing and the look of silence. So what is the September 30th movement? John Rusa, the prominent historian of modern Indonesia, he said this is the most mysterious and probably the most important event in Indonesian history. There's still ongoing debate about what actually happened. So I just briefly say what is generally agreed upon among historians. So before dawn on October 1st, 1965, Indonesian army units from the Presidential Palace Guard abducted and later killed six senior anti-communist generals. However, the next day, Suharto, at the time was a major general in the Indonesian army, he launched a very effective counterattack. So in the process of his rise to power, Suharto initiated a nationwide anti-communist campaign, and it escalated into one of the worst mass killings of the 20th century. So the generally agreed upon figure is that at least 500,000 people were killed. So because the leader of the Indonesian Communist Party, Aidit, he was a major participant. So the Indonesian army made aggressive charges that, you know, this is a communist coup d'etat and the Chinese Communist Party was responsible for exporting revolution abroad.
I see. Well, yeah, I mean, that's a great little potted history, I think, of certainly the kind of national construction efforts and so on that much of this book revolves around. Within that, and it's not necessarily at the core of the concerns of this book, but I'm just wondering, since what one key element of China's own PRC era nation building is also the treatment of minority groups, and this is obviously a very topical issue at the moment with what's going on China's peripheries, including in Xinjiang. But I just wonder whether Indonesia pursued a similar policy. I mean, as you say, it crosses all of these dazzling array of different islands and different spaces. My little brother was actually recently doing a high school project in geography and seemed to arrive at the problematic conclusion that Indonesia isn't a place, because I think he was expecting something that was a bit more glued together than I've debated him on the subject, but it is somewhere that has a tremendous internal diversity if you take the borders of the state as the container. So how did Indonesia's own domestic kind of ethnicity policy, if you like, and language policy operate during this time?
Right. So I think your little brother might not be wrong completely, because when the Indonesian nationalist leader proclaimed independence, actually this country they were liberating was not yet born, right? It's still kind of like all these islands with a very thin veneer of shared history. How do you bring them together as a nation? And that's the main challenge. And I think one of the main driving force of modern Indonesian history, right? How do you negotiate the interests of different ethnic groups, political groups, while engineering a coherence among different segments of the society? So going back to the issue of ethnic Chinese and Indonesia, so just follow up with our previous discussion about these three key points, right? So we stopped by 1965. So the book actually, so for me, writing, I wrote my dissertation actually the backwards. So I started with 1965. And the question I have was actually the question that was repeatedly posed to me by my informants or interviewees when I was conducting the field work. Many of them are ethnic Chinese Indonesia. And their question was that in this generation, basically, they grew up under the Soeharto regime. Some grew up under the Soeharto regime. Some already came to age before that. And so Soeharto regime instigated systematic government-led discrimination against the ethnic Chinese, right? So the ethnic Chinese had a specific designation on their national ID card. Chinese language education was banned. Chinese cultural festival celebrations were also banned. So this policy was basically started around late 1960s and lasted until the downfall of Soeharto around the Asian financial crisis in 1998, right? So the question became, right, these ethnic Chinese Indonesia asked me, so what have we done wrong, right? We've been told that this is a fitting retribution to the disloyalty of the ethnic Chinese, right? You guys are not really pledging loyalty, being faithful to the Indonesian nation. And beyond that, there is this implicit association between Chineseness and communism. So Soeharto regime's population propaganda goes that basically China engineered a communist coup d'etat in Indonesia, right? And the Chinese in Indonesia were implicated. And they were like ongoing dispute also about the Chinese experience in 1965, 1966, right? So the Cold War generation of journalism basically say this is a Chinese genocide. And later on, like scholars such as Robert Cribb and Charles Cubbs contested that portray. And now I think a new generation of scholarship show that of course, the majority of victims were targeted not because of their ethnicity, but because of their political affiliation with the Indonesian Communist Party. But ethnic Chinese, because of this racial category, they are more vulnerable to violence, to harassment, to imprisonment without legal process. So also, I think 1965 was the starting point of this whole narrative of Chinese being dirty in Indonesian political context. So more recently, we see like the imprisonment of Jakarta Governor Aho, who is ethnic Chinese and also Christian. There was mass protests against him and a very controversial blasphemy charges. So we still see that kind of narrative playing out nowadays.
Right, right. And it's, I think that the highlighting that you do there of the entanglements or the kind of substitutions of class and ethnicity or race one for the other over time, extremely revealing for a sort of broader kind of studies of ethnicity and race on a wider international level. So I think that really speaks to that very well. You've set us up pretty well there too to move into the beginning first few chapters of the book, in which you basically document the sort of struggle or the kind of tussle between the Chinese Nationalist Party and the Chinese Communist Party, who were fighting the civil war for much of the early period that this book covers. And so, as you say, you have this curious contrast between the Chinese in Indonesia at one point being identified as sort of merchants and dominating the economy, and on the other hand, being associated as communists and, you know, spreading global revolution. This is a, you know, extremely fertile and productive kind of minimal pair of contrast there, I think. So could you kind of give us a picture? It's actually the first sort of four chapters, I think, that treat these dynamics between nationalist and communist tendencies. Could you say how the dynamics played out among the Indonesian Chinese community? How was going on back in the Chinese mainland kind of get reflected in this distant Southeast Asian?
Right. So, absolutely. So I think the competition between the Republic of China with its capital in Taipei and People's Republic of China with its capital in Beijing is something that actually surprised me. So I didn't realize that was a domineering feature of the Chinese community in Indonesia before I went into the fieldwork. So just to provide some background, so in 1949, basically communists won the mainland and nationalist government evacuated to Taiwan. And the nationalist government, interestingly, it has extensive system of penetrating and influencing and mobilizing the ethnic Chinese in Indonesia. So in my book, I actually told us kind of a curious but interesting story of Wu Lixin. So this guy was born and raised in Java, and he later died in Java too, and he was conscripted to underground like intelligence network led by the notorious Chinese Nationalist Party Status Bureau, the Juntong. He was killed during the Japanese occupation, but his father wrote a petition to the Chinese Nationalist Government Consul General in Indonesia, asking him to be recognized as a martyr of the Republic of China, not the Republic of Indonesia, although he basically was born, raised, and later buried in Indonesia. So his short life really tells the extent to which the Chinese nationalist government invested in mobilizing overseas Chinese. So before 1949, right, so the Chinese nationalist government had formal diplomatic relations with Indonesia. It was able to negotiate with the Indonesian government through a formal diplomatic channel, whereas the Communist Party was just this oppositional party. It didn't have institutional support, so it had to rely more on the informal, the softer people-to-people network. So the vehicle through which the Chinese Communist Party spread its influence among the Chinese Indonesia was mainly through a group of left-leaning literatis or intellectuals, like people like Hu Yuzhi, which also appeared in your book. I didn't know he traveled all the, he traveled all the way along the Trans-Siberian Railway. So after that, I guess after that trip to Russia, he arrived in Southeast Asia, and together with him, the renowned poet Yu Dafu, and of course, Baran, who later became the first Chinese ambassador to Indonesia. So they, many of them were either like dispatched by the party as kind of undercover agents to influence the diaspora, or they were just seeking a refuge during the Japanese occupation. And they formed really extensive personal connection with the local Chinese, Chinese youth, and particularly on the island of Sumatra. So after 1949, the position of the communists and the nationalists shift, right? It's kind of reversal. So now the government of Indonesia recognized the People's Republic of China, right? So the Republic of China, Taipei, lost its formal diplomatic representation. But interestingly, in the shadow of the Cold War, the Indonesian, especially the Islamic forces, the right-wing forces, were still very comprehensive about this, like this shadow of Red China. So they allowed the Chinese Nationalist Party organizations to operate, to continue to operate in Indonesia as a counterbalance to so-called communist China. So we see this kind of a backhanded diplomacy, backdoor diplomacy, and kind of also competition on the civic level, right? So this blue versus red, so Taipei versus Beijing competition for leadership, whether it's Chinese civil societies or Chinese language schools or Chinese language media newspapers. That was a dominant feature of the diasporic society in the 1950s.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious, ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor's the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
And you, well, and you cover really well, I think, the kind of competing efforts of the different sides to bring people in, and also the you know, really can't be stressed enough the kind of incredible complexity on the ground of people speaking different languages and with differing extents of either Indonesian or sort of old Chinese or new Chinese identification, and all of the questions over citizenship and loyalty and identity that this throws up, of course, well before this more, I guess, forceful Suharto era that you highlighted just a few minutes ago. But, you know, I think you navigate this tremendously well. But one person who I think acts as a sort of focal point for crystallizing a lot of this complexity is this guy, Bai Ren, the first PRC ambassador to Indonesia, who you mentioned earlier too. So could you just give us a picture of his biography, his kind of hopping between the two locations, and what it is that his experiences say more generally about this era and indeed Cold War history, perhaps?
Right. So Bai Ren, he's on the cover of my book. So Bai Ren is his pen name, which means common man. He's like, I guess, legal name is Wang Renshu. So he's quite a recognized like literary figure in Shanghai. He edited the complete work series of Lu Xun. So between 1942 and 1947, he lived in North Sumatra. And he is a true Marxist, I would say, very romantic. So during his stay in Sumatra, he forged really close ties with the local ethnic Chinese youth. So I used to joke like he's like Bernie Sanders. He's very popular among young people because of his like very like leftist belief, and somehow also very promoting this idea that, you know, racial divisions can always be overcome by class solidarity. So he really asked the young people in North Sumatra translate all these like progressive magazines they were reading into Bahasa Indonesia, urged them to talk to the so-called indigenous communities, and he tried to reach out to actually the local branch of the Indonesian Communist Party, but without much success. And he is a literary figure, and he wrote the Song of Indonesia. So basically singing praises for this newborn Republic of Indonesia. And he very much opposed the Chinese nationalist government's policy. So what did he oppose the most? That is, the nationalist government actually insisted the right of blood nationality decree, which suggests that, you know, all the children of Chinese citizens will be Chinese citizens no matter where they were born, right? And Byron think the best solution will be for the Chinese to integrate or assimilate to the Indonesian nation, to embrace the newborn Indonesian nation, and especially for the mid-class Chinese businessmen to donate their property to the Indonesian nation. And he also famously wrote this play. It's called The Temple of Five Ancestors. So it's based on a real event, but he, of course, romanticized it. So it's about like a laborers' revolt against a Dutch plantation owner. And he basically framed it as a case in which, you know, whether it's the Dayak, the Gayuks, all the Malays, all the ethnic groups can join hands, right, for the liberation of the proletarian. And but after he, so he was expelled by the Dutch because of his political activism. He returned as the first ambassador, but he was sacked before his term ended. And the reason was that he allowed one of the main journalist Wang Jiyuan, he's a left-wing journalist, to seek refuge in the Chinese embassy in Jakarta during a purge by the Indonesian government, but without seeking approval from Beijing. So that constitutes, in Indonesian eyes, intervention in Indonesian domestic politics. And he, in his self-reflection, he actually confessed that it's a cardinal sin as an ambassador that he still view his most important task as promoting world revolution, especially through the youth. And during the Cultural Revolution, he actually revised the play Temple of Five Ancestors. He added lots of Cultural Revolution scenes, like all the laborers were reciting Mao's Little Red Book. And he passed away very tragically in his hometown in rural Zhejiang. And in his will, he actually asked his family to spread half of his ashes to the sea so that his spirits could come back.
Right. Yeah, well, I think his biography and the way it's kind of woven in and out of a lot of the other stories that you tell is a real kind of captivating thread that is there in the book as a whole. But moving on, we've kind of looked a bit there at the kind of Chinese angle, I guess, on how approaches to Indonesia were made during this this period. But how were they received, I guess, is the natural next question. And the next couple of chapters deal with this, the kind of idea of there being a Chinese problem, in quotation marks, as perceived by local pribumi Indonesian population. How did, with all of this kind of, all of these machinations, some at times from Beijing, at times from Taipei, at times from, you know, just local activities such as Byron, perhaps as a kind of more organic, on the ground kind of activist, what were the local Indonesian sort of reception of all of this, and how did attitudes towards the Chinese evolve?
Right. I think the so-called Chinese problem in the context of Cold War Indonesia, it's kind of an umbrella, right? I think at least first and foremost is a reflection of the internal political struggle between the left and the right in Indonesia. So in other words, the Chinese problem, the ethnic Chinese were kind of hijacked by the competing political actors in Indonesia. So one in chapter 6 of my book, I actually focus on the presidential decree number 10. So that was issued in 1959. Basically, it announced that all the Chinese peddlers in rural Indonesia, their licenses are going to be canceled. And the pribumi, the so-called indigenous Indonesians, were allowed or authorized to take over their business. So why was this launched? So in my book, I kind of try to show this was used by the right-wing, the Islamic parties, or the Indonesian army to attack the Indonesian Communist Party. So in other words, there is kind of a conflation of ethnic Chinese and the People's Republic of China and the Indonesian Communist Party. And in a sense, so the Chinese Indonesia, although many of them live in poverty, were in really like making their life based on really modest means, they were all regarded as capitalists, right? So they're regarded as this homogeneous whole and representing the capitalist class. And even the Indonesian Communist Party, they recognize this. So their attitude is basically, they spilled out very clearly that the right-wing forces are actually using this attack against ethnic Chinese as attack against the Communist Party, because its rapid rise in the Indonesian political scene and its close relationship with Soekarno kind of alarmed the right-wing forces, for example, the army and the Islamic groups. And secondly, I think the Chinese problem also reflects the tension or the domestic disagreement over Indonesia's foreign policy, right? So if we see in the late 1950s and early 1960s, right, when China and Indonesia enjoy good relationship, when China and Indonesia had tumultuous relationship, the Chinese Indonesia became targets of attack. But when the two countries were close, it created a new kind of electric atmosphere in which this long-going ethnic stereotype can still be exploited by some political forces. And I think certainly it also represents Indonesia as a newly established, vastly diverse nation, is anxiety over the borderlands, right? So one case I focus is the case of West Kalimantan. In West Kalimantan, there is establishment of Chinese mining companies known to the Dutch as the Gongsi. So they are kind of entirely autonomous, and it had control over Chinese laborers and as well as the indigenous population. So I wrote also in the chapter, I discovered basically from the Indonesian National Archives that the Attorney General were basically writing, oh, the officials we dispatched to West Kalimantan from Java, they couldn't understand what is really going on there, right? They couldn't read Chinese. There is no signifier of Indonesian nationalhood. They even recommend we should just ship tons of Indonesian national flag and pictures of Soekarno had it everywhere, right? So I think at least, the Chinese problem is this umbrella concept that encompass, you know, anxiety is about where domestic politics going in Indonesia, which directions foreign policy is going, and how to control this diverse and vast territory.
That is really kind of contemporary as well, something that has a very contemporary resonance. You look at, for example, how ordinary populations in, in the UK or in the United States or elsewhere today look at places like Russia and China and the like. It's often a kind of projection of internal and domestic anxieties and problems. And obviously, God knows that both countries
exactly
have a projection lot of those. Yeah, exactly. Anxiety. So yeah, I think you trace that very well, and I think it kind of accounts in part for why it is that, as you also sort of document, it was very difficult for a lot of this period to instill a sense of class solidarity that transcended ethnic difference, as Bahrain perhaps aspired to, but it didn't quite work out, as I think many romantic, as you put it, idealistic Marxists might have hoped. But moving on to this period, which, as you say, is a sort of apogee of the book's arc, this period around the events of 1965, the September the 30th movement, and this era of a very new kind of revolution in both Indonesia and in the People's Republic of China, namely the movement to the Suharto regime and the Cultural Revolution in China, of course. So how did the onset of both of these very sort of turmoil-filled periods in both countries affect the kind of experiences of the diaspora, and how did it confront them with new problems?
Right. So in chapter 7 to 9, my book, I kind of describe how there is a synchronized rise of both onset of cultural revolution in China and the rise of Soeharto regime in Indonesia. And this kind of tumultuous rupture of Sino-Indonesian relations kind of feed into propaganda and domestic mobilization in both countries, right? So in China, it was used in domestic propaganda to kind of warm up, if you could use that word, to the domestic audience, right? For mass mobilization for the Cultural Revolution in Indonesia, the attacks on Chinese embassy, consular, news agency play a very important role in legitimizing the rule of Soeharto. So I just talk a little bit how like Beijing used the Sino-Indonesian diplomatic rupture as a kind of domestic mobilization tool. So I highlight earlier, like in 1955, at the time China was pursuing a kind of peaceful approach in foreign relations. It was seeking friends, seeking a peaceful accommodation. But in 1965, Chinese diplomacy derailed from that pause. So basically, that radicalization led to China's reckless handling of bilateral relations with Indonesia. So one person that dramatized this Sino-Indonesia diplomatic rupture was Yao Dongshan. Those familiar with Cultural Revolution history might be familiar with the image in which he was holding Mao in one arm and holding Jiang Qing, Mao's wife, in another arm. So he's like a Cultural Revolution media star, influencer. So he was sent to Indonesia as the charge d'affaires, and he violated diplomatic protocol by directly arguing and provoking the Indonesian army. But back home, when he was expelled, and back home when he arrived in Beijing, he was welcomed as a red diplomatic fighter. And also Radio Beijing just kept blasting criticism against Soeharto. And so I mentioned earlier, the Chinese embassy in Jakarta was under various rounds of attacks. So in retaliation, the Red Guards actually raided and ransacked the Indonesian embassy in Beijing. Right, so this, there's all these drama going on, kind of formulated this narrative that China is under crisis. There is this anti-China, anti-Chinese, evil wind instigated by the Western imperialists going on around the world. So heightened this sense of crisis and help Mao to add momentum for the Cultural Revolution.
I see. Yeah. Well, it's a particularly dramatic period from the Chinese side there, for sure, as you've outlined. And this is also a time when China, with the Sino-Soviet split being concurrent with the Cultural Revolution, is seeking a kind of growing role as a purported leader in international socialist affairs. So was it the case that during this era, China, or did Beijing kind of increase its agitation on the ground in Indonesia? Was there actually an increase in the level of attempts to encourage socialist and Chinese loyal socialist movements in Indonesia, as sort of had been alleged in that earlier period when there was a kind of a massacre and so on? Was that actually going on?
Right. That's a very interesting question, I guess. One could possibly argue that there is a parallel radicalization of both Chinese and Indonesian foreign policy in the early 1960s, right? So China and Indonesia both like superstars in Bandung, but later on, when they tried to organize a second Bandung in 1965, it failed spectacularly. And it's largely because they were pursuing kind of a radical brand of anti-imperialism. They want to fight both the Soviet Union and the United States at the same time, right? So no other countries want to follow them. So they're basically isolated. And then the question goes, right? So since Indonesia is such a luring potential partner for China, would China actually sponsor a communist coup d'etat in Indonesia? right? So that's the million-dollar question. Like, did China really engineer the coup? My answer is no, based on the following reason. First of all, one key document I review in the book is the dialogue between Aidit, the Indonesian Communist Party leader, and Mao Zedong. It's in August 1965, so shortly before the September 30th movement. And at the time, Sukarno, he's not really well. He was sick, and there was international speculation that he might die soon and that might cause instability on the Indonesian political scene. So Mao asked Aidit, what are we going to do? And Aidit laid out this plan, which is very sophisticated and highly resembled what exactly happened on October 1st, 1965. So he said, we're not going to do the Chinese way of armed uprising or the rural villages around the city. So we're not going to do that. We're going to set up a revolutionary committee consisted of both the right, the middle, and the left, so that we will confuse the enemy. If we show our red flag right away, the enemies can attack us very easily. So I guess in terms of design, this doesn't sound very Chinese, right? And another fact is that in terms of intention, right, it doesn't really serve Beijing any good to stage a coup d'etat against Sukarno, right? Sukarno is pursuing this radical leftist line. His best friends besides China were like North Vietnam, North Korea, right? And he had a cozy relationship with the Indonesian Communist Party. So it will serve China's interest more if the alliance between the Indonesian Communist Party and Sukarno continue on, right? And last but not least, most importantly, if you look at the amount of military aid, China just lagged far, far behind the Soviet Union and the United States. So in other words, China didn't have that capacity to project its military power to Indonesia or to directly intervene in Indonesia. So that's, I guess that's the broader answer, but on the diplomatic level, right? On the level of like human stories, diasporic life, sure. I mean, the momentum of the mass mobilization of the pro-Beijing Chinese were actually just gone out of control of Beijing. So although the Chinese government was happy to see that, you know, the pro-Beijing Chinese were gaining the upper hand against the pro-Taipei Chinese, it definitely served China's interest. But the degree of their activism actually exceeded the level Beijing regarded as beneficial to its diplomacy. Right, Indonesia. And I think, and especially,
yeah, that's exactly the kind of thing that we miss focusing only on the diplomatic kind of interaction between capital cities and the sort of global scale. I mean, you do tell the stories of the leaders flying around the world and this kind of ridiculous circus, trying to stage a second Bandung conference, and you know, kind of grabbing each other at random meetings in other locations across the world, in North Africa and so on. Of course, that's all important stuff, but what's going on the ground and whether or not it exceeds the limits of what anyone is trying to encourage through active diplomacy is such an important angle. And throughout here, you know, we see the local population of Chinese people in Indonesia being sort of pulled from pillar to post and engaging in all kinds of different, more organic projects, and you chart that just as well as you document the kind of top level diplomatic affairs. And so, moving on, I guess it in some ways seems that, you know, at least as I was reading it, that one of the most fascinating and really also kind of tragic comic, if you will, parts of the story was saved right to the end here, namely the experiences of the Indonesian Chinese who returned. And returned is itself a problematic notion when you consider that some of those who were going to China from Indonesia at the time were descendants of people who'd been in China, in Indonesia, for many, many generations, and or had come from, you know, a different country historically, even if they'd come from the same village. Now the PRC was a different place from whatever had been there before. So this idea is a complex one, but of course their experiences were, you know, just as kind of diverse and rich and colorful as all of those you document throughout the book. So could you say a little bit about how they kind of responded, or what kind of examples you brought out here of the response to the new socialist homeland among these returnee Indonesian Chinese?
Right. So this is actually part of fieldwork I probably enjoy the most. So I love the entire fieldwork as well. So I visited five what is called overseas Chinese farms in the three southern coastal provinces of Guangdong, Fujian, and Hainan. And so on these farms were basically most of the Chinese, Indonesian were relocated, right? So what is an overseas Chinese farm? It's basically virgin land given to those who, quote unquote, return to China for them to build their life anew, right? And as you mentioned, it's kind of paradox because the Chinese Indonesia, they were ethnic minority and they were kind of on the margins of Indonesian society. But once back in the PRC, they were again on the margins of the society, and they were again regarded as disloyal to the government. And whereas Indonesia, the label that separated them from the majority is this label being Chinese, right? And in back in China, it's like all these habits, like for example, their habits of taking daily shower were labeled as bourgeois or capitalist, their love for music, right, playing guitar or wearing like white cut jeans or regarded as hooliganism. And all these political labels were very confusing to them. So once arrived in China, their destiny were basically very diverse. So only a minority of them were able to find jobs in the cities. But ironically, actually, most of them were city dwellers back in Indonesia. So most of them had to go to the countryside and to start their life as farmers and peasants. And the state attitude toward them is also very complex. So on the one hand, the overseas Chinese is a very important resource for socialist China, for one thing, to gain foreign currency, right, foreign exchange through the overseas Chinese remittance network. Another thing is to gain access to strategic goods such as rubber, because in 1950, China was basically under the U.S. imposed embargo, right? So I encounter fascinating stories such as how the ethnic Chinese from Indonesia, the students who went to China for higher education, they actually helped to smuggle the seeds and rubber seeds to Hainan. So the island on which now is the major producer of rubber in China. And but at the same time, right, for them to learn this language, new language of socialism, was very difficult. And adapting to the socialist system was very confusing. Like the whole planned economy, command economy, was very confusing for them. They don't know how to navigate through all these certificates, how to do purchase, and they don't understand why they have to conduct criticism and self-criticism. And they divide lots of these strategies of everyday resistance, to quote James Scott's word, and they have all these like songs about it, kind of sarcastically criticizing the motherland, saying like, oh, you know, the motherland's great, three cabbages a day, like they only have cabbages to eat. And one of my interviews showed me this photo in which they have this, what they call like a pool boys club. I couldn't show the photo on the podcast. So basically, so they're wearing all these like very flashy white shirts and Western style jeans. And they have a blackboard on which they write like, oh, this boy has no time, no money, and no love.
Right. Yeah. In English, right?
In English, exactly. English.
This photo I found completely unbelievable. It's in the book. And at least from a sort of northern Chinese perspective, perhaps, it is unbelievable that that was during the Cultural Revolution, because it kind of looks like the 60s anywhere, you know, or at least the 60s that was going on in London, or, you know, places very far from Mao era China. And, you know, they've got kind of these hairstyles and these sort of, you know, kind of cool clothes. And yeah, it's a
it does look like a Beatles-ish, right?
Right, yeah. Exactly. It really has that kind of vibe about it. But I'm sort of, you know, I was reminded in your description of these returnees and their sort of use, I guess, to the new socialist state in part of the Zainichi Koreans who were induced to return to North Korea, also not during a similar period during the Cold War, and were obviously very useful for that North Korean government for getting foreign currency and also lots of nice luxury items from Japan and so on. Of course, they ultimately fared far worse than this Chinese community. So one kind of concluding point that you make is the contribution of some of these returnees to China's ultimate opening up a couple of decades later that I began my introduction with. So what was their sort of role in shaping the path of new China, which in many ways was born down in the far south where some of these farms were?
Right. So on the comparative diaspora point, I think it's quite striking that North Korea, so the Zainichi in Japan who repatriated to North Korea, as well as Chinese Indonesia who kind of quote-unquote repatriated to socialist China, I think are the two only cases during the Cold War in which people migrated from the socialist camp, from the capitalist camp to the socialist camp. So majority of our like migration were in the opposite direction, right? So in terms of the Chinese Indonesians' contribution to China's reform and opening, quite interestingly, the location of the overseas Chinese farms on the coastal southern part of China, that's also the forefront of China's reform and opening. Right? So early stage of reform opening rely heavily upon the revival of this overseas Chinese remittance and investment network, right, from one thing. And not to speak like, not to talk about the fact that, for example, today, anecdotally, the Indonesian culture of some of the farm became a tourist attraction. And tropical produce such as coffee, pepper, and coconuts became part of the ecological landscape and agriculture economy of, for example, of Hainan. So in other words, these Cold War migrants, their behavior, their practices kind of subverted or transcended the Cold War. And in terms of, I think, the broader story I was trying to tell, right, going back to the story of Byron, I think he embodies this entanglement of diaspora and diplomacy, right? So the question ultimately I want to ask in this book is that how countries such as Indonesia and China, which were formerly colonized, how do they interact with each other when, you know, the citizenship was contested and political loyalty was very, very fluid and identity was malleable. And in your case, right, you studied China and Russia, and there was a physical boundary or borderland or boundary. But in the case of China and Indonesia, there's no geographic boundary. But there is kind of the existence of the ethnic Chinese kind of give rise to a social frontier that can be traversed maybe more easily and subconsciously in a way. So ultimately, I hope the book tells a story when, you know, when kind of diplomacy inevitably intersect with domestic issues of ethnic minority integration and class issues.
Yeah, well, I think it absolutely does. And I got a huge amount out of the book on both counts. I think the story you mentioned there of the combined contribution of the overseas Chinese returnees to both the grand scale reform and opening period within China and to the local ecology where they're growing coconuts and so on is a good metaphor for the sort of dual tracks that the book, I think, so elegantly interweaves as a whole. But Talmor, thank you so much for discussing all of this today with us. I mean, it's been a really fascinating interview. Before we let you go, perhaps I'll just ask our traditional final question, which is, what is it you're working on now? Where has your trajectory taken you since the completion of this book?
Right. So I'm starting a new project on Shenzhen. So I grew up in Shenzhen in a migrant family, and I'm trying to use the story of Shenzhen to tell the broader trajectory of China's reform and opening. So kind of a follow-up with the story of the return, the so-called returned overseas Chinese from Indonesia. I guess the theme of migration is still there. Right now, I'm focusing the early period under socialism. So I'm looking at illegal migration from Shenzhen to Hong Kong in the 1960s. And I'm trying to review some kind of mini reform efforts during the height of socialism. So there were experiments with market mechanism all the way back, actually, in the 1960s.
Well, that'll be an equally, I'm sure, excellent contribution to our sort of more complicated and nuanced understanding of this era of extremes and of, you know, kind of categorical declarations of political movements and so on, to see what's going on the ground and how it's a lot more complicated. It's an incredibly valuable effort. So yeah, that'll be wonderful to read as well. Well, Tamil, thank you so much for appearing on the show today. It was really great talking to you.
Thank you, Ed. Such a great pleasure talking to you.
Well, and listeners, thank you as well for listening to New Books in East Asian Studies. If you've made it this far, it's a podcast channel on the New Books Network, and it will be back with you again very soon. Goodbye.